I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
As many as 3,000 people are reported dead following a massive train collision at a North Korean train station. The explosion reportedly involved a train carrying oil and another carrying liquefied petroleum gas. North Korean leader Kim Jong-il reportedly passed through the station as he returned from China earlier in the day. Martin Sirki is the Reuters News Bureau Chief in Seoul, South Korea. Martin, what do we know about the crash so far?
Well, the details are still very sketchy, but what does seem to be clear by now is that there has been a very large explosion in this city near the Chinese border with North Korea, inside North Korea.
Is there any speculation that it might have been anything other than an accident?
Not so far. Kim Jong-il was passing through that particular train station about 9 hours before the explosion took place. It may be that the line was clear for Kim Jong-il's train to go through and that other train traffic was being held up on the line. And after he had passed through, they were trying to get the trains getting back to normal and that an accident happened. That's conjecture at this stage. But what I'm saying is it seems almost inconceivable that the two events are not linked in some way.
We understand that the victims could be Chinese as well as North Korean. It's a porous border.
Very much so. Lots of people traversing the border, traders, North Koreans trying to leave quite often, but there are lots of traders coming in and out in both directions every day.
There are descriptions of an explosion that pretty much incinerated the train station and the surrounding area. Will they be able to cope not just with the dead, but with the injured?
I would suggest that it would be very difficult for them to cope with a large number of injured people, particularly if they are burns victims. They really don't have the medical infrastructure. And in fact, we have unconfirmed reports that some of the injured have been taken across the border into China, but we don't have any confirmation of that.
Of course, North Korea is not commenting on the accident.
So far, North Korea has said nothing publicly. North Korean TV, up until about 2 hours ago, was still broadcasting the same kind of military music and songs that one would hear every evening. In addition, the North Korean telephone lines appear to have been cut across the border into China, which means that it's very difficult to find out what's going on there.
Martin, thank you so much.
Okay, pleasure.
Martin Nazurki, Reuters bureau chief based in Seoul, South Korea, speaking about today's train wreck in North Korea that has reportedly killed up to 3,000 people.
Over the past 2.5 years, the number of overseas visitors to the United States has fallen by 30%. Secretary of State Colin Powell told the House committee yesterday that the loss of tourists, students, scientists, and business travelers is already causing unwanted economic effects. Powell blamed the decline in visitors on increased scrutiny of foreigners and new travel restrictions that include fingerprinting, photographs, and sometimes lengthy interviews. Well, one man who recently had trouble entering this country is Zain Ibrahim, a journalist and the manager of the Bush Radio community radio station in Cape Town, South Africa. Zain Ibrahim was on his way into the United States last week to give a speech to mark the 10th anniversary of democracy in South Africa when... Well, let's let him tell it. Hello, Zain.
Hi, Michael.
Okay, so you flew from Cape Town to Amsterdam and then
yes.
changed planes to go to Detroit.
Yes.
So the airplane lands in Detroit. What
yes.
happened?
Well, the captain tells us, please remain seated. Security personnel will be coming on board. And then these guys came on board. Four people came by my seat. And the fifth one stopped and asked me if I was Zain Ibrahim. And I said, yes. And he said, would you come with us, please? And I asked, well, why? Well, we want to talk to you. So about what? He said, please don't make it difficult. And I understand that kind of language. I'm a journalist, you know. I've been a journalist since I was 18 years old. I'm 65 years old. So it was rough during apartheid. I had to flee into exile very early on. So we're used to this type of thing. And so I got up and went with them.
And where did you go? Where did they take you?
they took me to some place in the airport, a room in the airport, and started to question me.
What were they questioning you about?
About my travels, where am I going, where have I been, what. And then they opened up a dossier, and they had information on me.
They had information on you?
It was clear, yes, by some of the questions they were asking.
So, I mean, so what was the interrogation like? I mean, were they polite?
It was very polite. I wasn't bum-rushed off the plane,
right,
as I learned when I landed here in Cape Town. Right. I'm reading stories that I don't recognize.
How long were you held for?
Okay, at 9:30 the plane came in. I was on a hold for about 8 hours. I got to my hotel about 10 o'clock that night.
Why do you think you were detained?
Okay, I've gone through this 100 times. I asked them, and there was no answers. I thought, okay, I have Canadian citizenship. I have South African citizenship. I have permanent residence in the Netherlands. I'm a journalist. I have a Muslim name. All of the above.
What sort of questions were the agents asking you for 8 hours?
They were asking me about my career, and they asked me about the programming on Bush Radio. They asked me about the program during the Iraq War. Do you remember when President Bush gave Saddam Hussein a 48-hour ultimatum?
Of course.
Now, we gave President Bush a 48-hour ultimatum to stop the saber rattling and suspended all our programming and played John Lennon's Give Peace a Chance 576 times. That was picked up by World Press.
Do you think the agents in Detroit knew about this?
Well, they asked us about our campaign during the war.
Let me ask you. When you've been detained for 8 hours in this fashion, what do they say when they let you go?
Nothing.
They just say you can go.
Yes.
And then you go off and you're going to give a talk on democracy in the new South Africa.
Yes.
So do you reflect ironically on giving this talk on democracy after having this experience in the United States?
You see, like I say, I've been through apartheid, okay? I know how edgy and how fidgety the U.S. is at this time. I wasn't surprised. Somebody asked me, do you fault the agents? I said, the only thing I fault them for, they could have done it differently. I could have walked up to the gate, and then they said, excuse me, would you go over there for secondary questioning? I would have had no problem with that. But to come on the plane and escort me off the plane, that wasn't cool. That wasn't friendly. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do.
That wasn't friendly.
Would you ever consider coming back to the U.S.?
At the drop of a hat. I love the United States and the people of the United States.
Zain Ibrahim, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, brother.
Zain Ibrahim is a journalist and the manager of Bush Radio in Cape Town, South Africa. While tourists, students, and maybe some democracy advocates, although not Zain Ibrahim, are staying away from the U.S., America remains a magnet for impoverished people, particularly from the nations to the south. A dangerous magnet for most. Yesterday in Los Angeles, police raided an 1,100-square-foot house in the Watts neighborhood and found more than 110 illegal immigrants. They had been chained inside by the people smugglers, or coyotes, who brought them over the border. Well, I'm joined on a line now from Los Angeles by Virginia Kice of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service. Hello, Virginia.
Good morning.
Okay, first of all, tell us a bit about this specific incident.
Our officers were called out late Tuesday night to a scene in Watts. What they found when they arrived there was more than 80 people who had been confined, as you said, inside a tiny home. That home, the bars had been placed on the windows, or the windows had been boarded up. The human smugglers had stripped all of the light bulbs from inside the house, so these people were sitting there in virtual darkness. Try to imagine being confined inside a dark home. Over 100 people were in there, we believe, at one time, 1,100 square feet. I mean, the conditions were just appalling. On top of that, our agents also discovered 3 handguns inside the residence and a machete. We speculate that those weapons were probably used to try and keep the smuggled migrants under control.
Now, were they being let out to work? I mean, hadn't they paid the coyotes?
What typically happens in these cases is that the people pay a fee up front for transport into the United States, and when they get here, the smugglers will often then hold them and try to extort further sums of money from their family and relatives. We believe the majority of these individuals were destined for communities on the East Coast.
Now, This is a story that's made national news because of the numbers found in this one small house. I mean, is this a common occurrence in L.A. still?
Tragically, this scenario plays out several times a month here in Los Angeles and in communities all along the southern border. Human smuggling has become a multi-billion-dollar international industry. There's a lot of money in it. More and more organized criminal rings are getting involved because of the huge sums that can be made, and that has begat all kinds of problems. It has fostered tremendous crime, violence, and sadly, the victims are often the smuggled migrants themselves.
Well, this is not a new problem. It's been going on for decades. Does the Immigration Service not do education programs, not just along the border, but well south in Chiapas and in Central America, where so many of these migrants are coming from?
The federal government has been reaching out to foreign countries and to the migrant community here in the United States for many, many years, trying to promote awareness about this problem, to acquaint people with the dangers associated with contracting with smugglers. But the magnet that draws people here is very, very powerful. And, of course, the smugglers themselves are not going to tell these people about the risks they potentially face. They're going to pitch it as, you know, do business with me, I'll get you to the United States, I have a great track record, it'll only cost you this much money. No problem. They don't tell them about the sometimes stifling treks across the Arizona deserts. They don't tell them about packing them in the back of often airtight cargo vehicles. I mean, it's just really an unconscionable, tragic situation. But, of course, to the smugglers, these aren't human beings. They're simply cargo.
Now, you mentioned the Arizona desert. This particular group of people, I believe, came through, or it's suspected they came through Nogales, one of those twin towns along the border. Since 9/11 and increased security, has it been more difficult for coyotes to work? Are they still working the same routes they've always had?
Well, the Department of Homeland Security has taken a number of steps to enhance enforcement along the Arizona border, and I believe that effort is having a substantial impact. But, of course, the smugglers will always try to stay one step ahead of the enforcement authorities. So we can reasonably expect that since we've enhanced the enforcement pressure in Arizona, that some of these smuggling organizations will look to the California border, perhaps the Texas border, to try and get their human cargo across.
Virginia Kais, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Virginia Kais works with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service in Los Angeles.
Just ahead, how an aging population in China could have major implications for the rest of the world.
And later in the show, could the draft be coming back? Some lawmakers are talking about it.
There's more coming up, here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-il returned to his capital, Pyongyang, today as Korea reels from today's train catastrophe. Latest reports say casualties may reach 3,000. Mr. Kim had been in China for his first ever meeting with Chinese President Hu Jintao. Unofficial is the word used to describe the visit. And joining us on the line to tell us more from Beijing is Washington Post reporter Edward Cody. Hello, Ed. Now, this visit, we don't know the specifics about this visit. Can you fill us in?
Well, no, he doesn't go anywhere very often at all. As far as is known, this was his third trip to Beijing in his entire time as leader of North Korea. From what we're told, he hates to travel by airplane. That limits him some. When he came here, he came by train. So you wouldn't find him coming here for a medical checkup or for a weekend on the town.
Right. So then we can, as we look through the opacity of diplomacy in China, we can say that these talks must have been fairly serious because he wouldn't have made the effort to come from North Korea unless there was something important to discuss.
Yes. He has to get to know the new Chinese leadership. It's new to him anyway. It's a year old now. But more to the point, there is a pressing need for him to get economic aid. He needs it, and he needs it fast. The country just doesn't produce enough food to feed its people. There's also a pressing need to get this nuclear issue resolved. Vice President Cheney was here only last week telling the Chinese that the United States supports their diplomatic effort to resolve peacefully the nuclear crisis, but that it has to show some results sometime soon, because the danger is that while this diplomatic thing turns on and on and on, the North Koreans could be producing more nuclear devices.
Edward Cody, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Edward Cody is a reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke to us on a phone line from Beijing. A new study from the Center for Strategic and International Studies estimates that by the year 2040, China, a country of 1.3 billion people, will have more senior citizens than the total current populations of France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United Kingdom combined. And it says if China does not find a way to provide services and health care to those nearly 400 million elderly people, the implications will be enormous for China and the world. The author of the study is Richard Jackson, senior fellow at CSIS, and we tracked him down in Shanghai yesterday to talk about the crisis facing China.
It's a crisis that leaders are having a hard time focusing on, because historically, of course, the problem has been unchecked population growth and how to prevent the population of China from outrunning its resources. But China's about to undergo a dramatic demographic transformation.
And that's as a result of the government's policies encouraging one child per family?
Yes, in large part. It's a result of the decline in fertility. That is in part the natural consequence of rising living standards in China. As living standards rise, people tend to invest more in the quality of the smaller number of children rather than simply in the quantity. That's a transition that every country goes through on the way to modernity. But in China, it's been reinforced by the one-child policy.
How is this problem similar to the situation here in the U.S., where we're having a challenge funding our Social Security system?
Well, it's a similar challenge, but it's also a challenge with a difference. Today's great powers, the United States included, got rich before they got old. China will be the first major society to get old before it gets rich. And China is ill-prepared, quite frankly, to meet the challenge. We have a Social Security system. It's underfunded, but it supplies a degree of security to almost every American elder. In China, just one out of four workers has any pension at all. And the pension system is careening towards bankruptcy. The reason is that it's concentrated in the old state-owned sector, and the state-owned sector is downsizing. Young workers are leaving for the private sector where there's no coverage, leaving behind old workers and retirees.
There's also the dislocation that's going on as China goes through this transition from the command communist economy, and its economy is liberalized. Increasing numbers of peasants come in from the villages, swell the populations of the city, and put stress and strain on public services there, but also dislocate themselves socially and spiritually from a peasant background.
Well, this is absolutely true. As young people stream out of the villages into the cities, they leave behind their aged parents. At the same time, in the cities, modernization is leading to a rise in, how shall we say, individualistic Western values. Elders are being stripped of their traditional social status. And there's an additional dimension which might be worth talking about, because it's something of great concern in China, and that's the gender imbalance. There are far more boys born in China than girls. And the reason is that, particularly in the countryside, peasants need a son to care for them in old age. Actually, it's the daughter-in-law that does the caring. And so this has led to a looming crisis of shortage of caregivers in the future.
Without taking some steps to provide for the elderly, could this cause instability in the East?
China has to move aggressively to deal with this problem. On the other hand, if it does manage to confront the aging challenge, Frankly, its economic horizons are limitless. So there really is a choice that needs to be made and potentially very serious consequences, not just for China domestically, but quite frankly for the stability of the global economy and the global political system. Because after all, as we started out, China is a country of 1.3 billion people.
Richard Jackson, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Richard Jackson is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He spoke to us from Shanghai.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a new documentary by Jonathan Demme explores the life of his friend, the late Haitian journalist and freedom fighter Jean Dominique. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
With insurgent activity in Iraq growing in scale and sophistication, the number of American soldiers needed to bring security to the country is being hotly debated. Even the D word, draft, is being dusted off. Here's Republican Senator Chuck Hagel.
I'm just proposing us on the base for us to look at it, to explore. I'm not proposing a draft, but I think some kind of mandatory service for this country, for all our citizens, for the privileged, the rich, all those who have a lot, should be something we take seriously.
Hagel made the remarks yesterday on NBC's Today Show. The Fuhrer hasn't died down yet. On the line is Dr. Kenneth Allard, military analyst, Georgetown University professor, and a retired Army colonel. Hello, Kenneth.
Good morning. Let me point out that I was also a draftee.
And you were also a draftee in which conflict?
Vietnam era. I escaped the draft, if you will, by enlisting.
The draft-induced volunteer. Well, Senator Hagel brought the word out, although he then quickly tried to camouflage it with the idea of national service. But looking specifically at the conflict in Iraq, pretty clearly the 135,000 troops we have there have not been enough. So is there any military planning going on at the moment for a draft?
I would doubt it very seriously, because the simple fact of life is that, number one, the draft is not an immediate answer to the manpower shortages we have with respect to Iraq. The second reason why I doubt that that kind of planning is going on is because most people understand that the kind of professional force that we have put together after Vietnam, after the Cold War, is exactly the kind of force that does not need to have draftees. It needs manpower, but not draftees. So I think that more than anything else, there is an absolute abhorrence with the idea of returning to a draftee army.
Yesterday we spoke with a military analyst who was saying that given the level of insurgency on the ground now in Iraq, you could need up to 500,000 people in security forces, including Iraqis, it should be said. Does the U.S. have non-draftee troops now that it could send to Iraq to improve the security situation?
It has some, but well short of the 500,000 that you're talking about. The active army today is an army that is well under that figure, so you're simply not going to get it from there. But the idea that you can make better use of contract security forces, you can make of reserve, National Guard, we are trying all of those things, and I think we are very slowly coming to the end of that rope.
And do you think that's why Senator Hagel is bringing it up? Let's be fair, other people in Congress have been talking about this because there is the manpower shortage.
Yep. number one, this is the first post 9/11 election, and we have not had any kind of a discussion about what that is going to require of us in terms of the manpower resources. One of our most brilliant military sociologists, Charles Moskos, has a very famous phrase in which he has said, we have the GI Bill, but without having the GI. So there are all kinds of anomalies in our manpower situation that we have to look to in the aftermath of 9/11 and the aftermath and the continuing problem of Iraq.
Now, if there is a draft, do you think we would see a Vietnam-era lottery used?
One of the lessons that we learned from the Vietnam-era draft is not to ever do it like that again, in which you have enormous inequities, enormous unfairness. And I think there is a great degree of reluctance to go back to that, and there is a great understanding that you need to avoid that kind of thing in the future. I think what you are far more likely to see is a form of national service of which the military is but one option and in which everybody goes.
Dr. Kenneth Allard is a military analyst, Georgetown University professor, and author of Business as War.
Well, before the military draft ended in the U.S. in 1973, there was the draft lottery. 1968 was the bloodiest year of the Vietnam War. An average 200 U.S. soldiers killed a week. Over 600 died in 1 week in May. The military was depleted, but there were very few volunteers to fill vacancies, fewer enlisting for the increasingly unpopular war. So the U.S. began a reform of draft deferrals to try to make it less of a so-called poor man's war. And in 1969, the Selective Service instituted a lottery. Little blue balls filled with birth dates placed in a glass jar, drawn by hand, live on national TV and radio. Americans gathered in living rooms and college dorms to hear the number attached to their birth date. The higher the number, the less chance of being called up. For people of a certain age, the memory of waiting for that number is still vivid.
I remember coming home from school. My mother was in the kitchen. She was in tears. And she looked at me and she said, your brother's number is really bad. I think he's going to have to go to Vietnam. And then she launched into a whole rampage about the people who were able to send their kids to college. And she was out of her mind.
Do you have any memory of waiting for your number in the draft in the 70s?
Oh, sure. I was petrified, as was everybody I knew. I fell in the middle at about 157.
You remember that?
Oh, you bet. It was tense because at the time, I didn't really know what 157 meant. It turned out that in my district, they never got above 100, fortunately. But I remember a number of really sad folks on campus that night, good friends. Yeah, I didn't really know whether to approach them or not because, you know, you kind of felt guilty because, yeah, I wasn't celebrating. I was just like, who dodged a bullet? And those poor suckers that didn't.
I was a senior in high school, and it was winter in 72. And that was when everybody who was born in 1953, you know, turned 18 that year. So we were gathered around TV and saw the first few numbers being drawn. My number was 346, so I was pretty safe. I checked it about 22 times just to make sure. It was a very nerve-wracking time. If your number was up, you know, 8 months later, you would be in Saigon.
Does anyone remember the draft lottery? Or
I was number 248.
You remember your number?
Oh, sure. We had a big... When I was in college, we had everybody put a buck into this pool. And they took women and children before me on number 248.
At a very high number. Do you remember how you felt as you waited for the numbers?
We were drinking pretty heavily that evening.
Remember how you felt?
Relieved. My brother was in Vietnam at the time.
And you didn't feel any guilt about your relief?
Oh, no. Nothing at all. It was something that was... My father served in the service, and it was something that everybody growing up... It was something that we all believed in. If it was some other time, World War II or another era or something, you know, I might not have felt the same way.
I was number nine. It was number nine. It was awful. It was in college at the time, so it meant that I was going to get drafted when I finished college. It meant that I had to make a decision about what I was going to do, and And so I ended up joining the National Guard.
Preempting the draft.
To avoid the draft, yeah. That was the way I dodged the draft.
The thoughts of some people in the Boston area remembering the draft lottery, which began in 1969 and continued until the draft ended in 1973.
Still to come, if it's Thursday, it must be Illyria. We'll take a look at the new guidebook to the world of William Shakespeare's plays.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
Arlene Pressman had this question following an interview we did with a group called Follow the Women. They're bicycling from Beirut, Lebanon, through Syria and Jordan as a way of publicizing how the current situation in the Middle East affects women and children. But Arlene asks, one of your guests reported that Jewish women will not be participating in the bike ride because, she said, Jewish citizens are not permitted to enter Syria. Well, a member of my family who is Jewish and a U.S. citizen will be traveling to Syria this summer and has been assured that there are no such restrictions. Can you clarify? Yes, Arlene, we called the State Department, and what they told us is that they know of no restrictions on Jewish travelers to Syria. But since Syria does not recognize Israel, a person carrying either an Israeli passport or any passport with an Israeli stamp cannot receive a visa. Well, this story also brought a call from Stan Fleischman of Newton, Massachusetts.
I think they're being used as pawns in anti-Israeli propaganda. First of all, Israeli women, as you pointed out, weren't invited to participate. The second thing is, I don't know if you're aware that the official map on the website of Follow the Women doesn't show Israel. It instead shows Palestine. Now, it does show Jordan. Jordan was created out of the same British mandate as Israel, and this would say to me that the people who have this on their website believe that Jordan has more of a right to exist than Israel.
Beppe Gibson, who listens to Here and Now in Southern Oregon, wrote following our interview with actress Dame Helen Mirren, during the course of which we asked about stories in British media about her experience with a date rape. Beppe writes, I was disappointed and surprised to hear the question about date rape. I hate to say this, but it sounded so Diane Sawyer-like. I think that public radio's niche and role in our culture is important and would hate to see it drift in the direction that commercial cable news organizations have gone.
Thanks to Robert Kearns of Westchester, Pennsylvania, who listens on WHYY and called with this correction after an interview we did with Democratic Senator Bob Graham.
On that segment on Senator Graham, still a senator from the state of Florida. You said former senator. That's not true. I don't think he's going to run for re-election, but he's still a senator, and I want to bring that to your attention.
Robert, you're right on both counts.
And finally, our segment on the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's Othello awakened some memories from D.J. Marshall of Norton, Massachusetts. He writes, in the 1960s, in Los Angeles, I saw a rock version of Othello with Jerry Lee Lewis as a piano-pounding Iago. He was explosive. The show was titled Catch My Soul, I recollect. I never saw any indication that the production reached Broadway and was curious if any mention of it is included in the current anniversary celebrations. Well, we did some research, and apparently Lewis did appear in the Los Angeles production of Catch My Soul. It was made into a movie in 1974, but Jerry Lee opted to concentrate on his country career.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at HERE-NOW.org.
Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please remember to include your full name, phone number, and town where you live.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Did you know that there are 748 lines in Act Two of Shakespeare's Hamlet, or that the play might have been inspired by the death of Shakespeare's 11-year-old son, Hamnet, or that Freud used the character of Hamlet to illustrate his theory of repression? Well, what most of us do know is that actors around the world have delivered Hamlet's famous words on stage and in film hundreds of times.
Get thee to a nunnery. Why wouldst thou be a breeder of sinners? I am myself indifferent honest, but yet I could accuse me of such things that it were better my mother had not borne me.
Get thee to a nunnery. Why wouldst thou be a breeder of sinners? I am myself indifferent honest, but yet I could accuse me of such things it were better my mother had not borne me.
Get thee to a nunnery. Why wouldst thou be a breeder of sinners? I am myself indifferent honest, and yet I could accuse me of more things it were better my mother had not borne me.
Sir Laurence Olivier, Mel Gibson, and Ethan Hawke portraying Shakespeare's famous Prince of Denmark. Well, tomorrow is Shakespeare's birthday, and for those who can't get enough of the Bard, there's a new guide, The Essential Shakespeare Handbook. It's produced by DK Publishing, a company that usually handles how-to books and travel guides. Leslie Dutton Downer, one of the two authors of The Essential Shakespeare Handbook, is in the studio to tell us about it. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
I gleaned all those interesting facts about Shakespeare and Hamlet from your book, and there are so many others. Let's just, for a second, so that people can imagine, describe this book, because it is set up the way a travel guide is set up.
Well, that was the approach that we had in mind. We wanted to make a guide to Shakespeare, treating Shakespeare and his works as if they were a kind of country. So whether they're students who have to write essays on a Shakespeare play or take an examination, or people about to head into the theater wanting to know something about a play before attending it, we wanted to do something that would allow people to navigate through the works of Shakespeare, but also be visually excited before getting into it themselves.
You know, some people are going to say, Leslie, that this is a really beautiful form of Cliff Notes. Do you worry that some people will just
not want to go there because they feel they've already been?
Right.
Certainly that's not our intention. We're hoping that this will whet the appetites of possible readers and actors and theatergoers. And the way it's set up is to tantalize the reader to see Shakespeare in all different kinds of forms, whether that's in film or television form or reading the play.
Well, let's, you know, take the opportunity to look closely at one play. How about Macbeth? Page 358, and the lead line draws me in immediately. In Macbeth, Shakespeare's shortest but most unremittingly gruesome tragedy, a heroic and ambitious man murders his way to the Scottish throne. How did you go about presenting Macbeth?
Well, as with all of the plays, we like to open with a section that gives a sketch of the play's history, when it was first presented, as far as we know, a little bit about the sources that Shakespeare used. And then I think everyone who's seen a regular plot summary book, and there are many of them about Shakespeare on the market right now, and there have been lots of them for 100 years, will recognize that when you open up and you start to read a plot summary, you don't necessarily know what's going on. So we like to start instead with the backstory. What's happening? How do you explain what the basic dramatic conflict is, what the basic dilemma is? Then we have introduced the date of the play relative to the other plays, the length of the play relative to the shortest and longest plays.
And what do we know about the date? I mean, some would say that this is Shakespeare's golden era.
The play Macbeth is written in a very interesting period, right when Queen Elizabeth was leaving and King James was coming in. So it's that transition period between the two different reigns. Right in there, Shakespeare wrote 10 major plays in a short time, and 6 of those plays were among his most important tragedies. All of his important tragedies were written then, really.
We have a version with Ian McKellen, and we want to hear one of the soliloquies from Macbeth. But first of all, you address soliloquies in the book to point people to, you know, exactly where they are and what they mean. What do you say about them?
Soliloquies are really interesting because in the Middle Ages, the person who would go on stage and speak independently to the audience and talk to the audience directly would be Vice or Satan or some evil character who would explain how he was going to trap some innocent Christian person and make them suffer in hell. So as time goes by, Shakespeare does many unusual things with the soliloquy. It becomes a kind of speech where we can follow the inner world of a character and understand what thought process he's going through. So the soliloquies are very important to plays like Macbeth and Hamlet, where the characters are thinking a lot about their destiny and their fate and what they plan to do.
Is this a dagger which I see before me? The handle toward my hand? Come, let me clutch them. Have they not? I need to see this still. Are they not fatal vision, sensible to feeling as to sight? Or are they but a dagger of the mind, a false creation proceeding from the heat of blessed bread?
Ian McKellen as Macbeth. Well, why do you think Shakespeare endures? I mean, it's the ever-asked question, but since you've put this together, what has hit you?
Well, a lot of people think that Shakespeare is all about his language. A lot of people will say, well, he got all of his plots and all of his stories from other material that wasn't original, so it's really all about Shakespeare's English. The curious thing is that Shakespeare has been translated for a long time into many other languages and is extremely popular all over the world. It's not possible to explain that through his language alone. There's something more going on. Clearly, he puts stories together in a very interesting way, and he also seizes on the dramatic core of his stories. For example, in As You Like It, you'll remember that Rosalind goes into the Forest of Arden and discovers that Orlando has left her love poems attached to trees all over the place. That is a scene from a very famous Persian folk story, and people in the Persian-speaking world, whether Iran, Afghanistan, or Tajikistan, recognize that story immediately as their own material. People from all over the world can recognize in Shakespeare's stories elements of their own stories, and I think that's the most important thing. I've heard people from Egypt or Iran or sometimes even Japan argue that Shakespeare is actually from their place and not from England. So I think he's an unusual poet and stands alone as a poet and playwright because he belongs to everyone, not just because of his language, but also because of the way he tells stories and makes them relevant to people everywhere.
Well, Leslie, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Leslie Dutton Downer, co-author of The Essential Shakespeare Handbook. And this note, a legendary journalist is gone. Mary McGrory died last night at the age of 85 in the city she loved, Washington, D.C. For half a century, McGrory wrote about politics from the Army-McCarthy hearings of 1954 to the Iraq War, and about flowers and the poetry of Jane Austen with such flair and insight. She won journalism's highest honor, the Pulitzer, in 1974. Well, joining us on the line is Boston Globe columnist Brian McGrory, Mary's cousin. And Brian, I know you wrote about Mary with a great deal of pride in a column in November. She'd been sick for a while. Tell us, you know, one of the columns that jumps out for you, one that you were thinking about today.
Well, there are so many, Robin. I mean, the one thing that Mary did so well all through her years, right into her 80s, is she wrote reported columns. She wasn't somebody who just sat in her office here in Washington and just rhapsodized and waxed about politics. She was out there. She was in the Speaker's lobby. She was in the White House press room. She was everywhere, and she wrote so many wonderfully reported columns with just, you know, the perfect telling detail. She just had such a great eye on things, on life and on politics.
Her colleague David Broder told us during this last New Hampshire primary how much he missed her, first of all, but also that he still carries around a copy of the editorial she wrote after the assassination of JFK. People in Washington can still quote from that.
Oh, I mean, her great line, she said of John F. Kennedy, "I think he would have loved this," or "he would have liked this," of his funeral service. And she's such a great presence on the campaign trail. I mean, she really is missed out there because she loved reporters, and she loved the whole process of being on the bus and going to the bar afterwards and sitting around in groups of reporters and politicos just telling stories.
The line that she wrote about Kennedy, "He brought gaiety, glamour, and grace to the American political scene. That lightsome tread, that debonair touch, that shock of chestnut hair, that beguiling grin." Much of which can be said about her. Brian, our thoughts are with you, and in a few seconds, I hope it's some consolation that the greatest writers in Washington are going to be lining up to eulogize her.
I appreciate that, Robin, very much.
Yeah. Boston Globe columnist Brian McGrory on the death of his cousin, columnist Mary McGrory, who died last night after a long illness at the age of 85 in Washington, D.C.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.